Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle. Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On today's podcast, we are going to be talking specifically about practices, tactics, strategies to reduce blood glucose spikes, specifically after eating high carbohydrate meals, to keep us more insulin sensitive, to reduce the risk of insulin resistance so we can prevent the downstream effects of poor metabolic health like type 2 diabetes, certain types of cancer, dementia, and even cardiovascular disease, and even improve the management of some more vague symptoms like brain fog or pain or headaches. And then there is also the relationship between insulin resistance and things like PCOS as well. I'm diving into the studies that many people use to recommend certain glucose lowering strategies. And I'm asked frequently to comment them. So I think this is going to be a nice, honest, diligent dive into some of those things that I've looked at before. And I'm going to give you my opinion as to whether I think they're worth trying as well, which is great. And actually, in doing this exercise, I've actually become more bullish on certain elements in glucose lowering therapies as well. So non-pharmaceutical glucose lowering therapies. Overall, like I said in the previous podcast where I did a dive into insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity, which if you haven't listened to, I would listen to that first before listening to today's episode. But I believe these things are the extra elements that you'd want to stack on top of the real core foundational things that I think are going to have the biggest impact on insulin resistance and improving one's insulin sensitivity. I think these will definitely provide certain benefits depending on the person as well and their health status, as we'll get into. But these are not the mainstay of my suggestions. Like I said in the previous podcast, the best things you can do to prevent insulin resistance and keep yourself insulin sensitive, and you'll know about those things if you listen to the previous podcast about what those mean, you want to focus on exercise, diet, stress, and sleep. And I hasten to say exercise. That's going to be the biggest impact. Even though I'm a food guy, I love talking about diet. Exercise in the context of insulin resistance is going to be the biggest impact. So keeping good amounts of lean muscle mass as we age is the mainstay of improving metabolic health. These are the key interventions, right? But if you're listening to this episode first, I would highly recommend that if you want to learn more about insulin resistance, what it is, how it impacts your risk of disease, your risk of chronic conditions, go listen to that. It's a couple of episodes before. You'll learn about the importance of blood sugar regulation in the body, how tightly controlled it is, how insulin works, and all the different mechanisms of how insulin resistance can occur, and what we can do to become more insulin sensitive, and specifically those key pillars that I talked about earlier in terms of exercise, the different types of exercise, the dosing of those exercises, dietary strategies, and reducing overall saturated fat and focusing on fiber and plants. But today's podcast, we're going to talk about these popular strategies, specifically vinegar, which a lot of people ask me about, the order of food, also referred to as nutrient sequencing. So if you type in order of food, glucose, you don't really get much in PubMed. But if you type in nutrient sequencing, you'll get more studies. The impact of having a veggie starter or fiber whole food supplement, something that I'm really interested in, and moving after eating as well. And then I also want to talk a little bit about supplements. I don't really talk about supplements that much. I'm more of a whole food kind of person. But I think some whole food supplements are really interesting to talk about, and some that I've never heard of before. And do stick around to the end, because I have a supplement that I think could be one to watch, and no one is really talking about right now. So definitely stick around to the end, because I want to briefly touch on that. Before we get into this, if you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, or you're on any medications, you must discuss doing any supplement changes or dietary changes or whatever it might be with your practitioner before you do this, because you don't know. And actually, quite honestly, I don't know. A lot of people wouldn't realize the interactions that certain supplements or practices can have on your medication regime. So definitely go and speak to your practitioner, your doctor, your medical advisor, whoever it might be, before you do any of these different strategies, because that's super important. A quick refresher, what do we mean? I'm gonna say the word metabolic health a number of times in today's podcast. What do we mean? What I'm referring to is a state of optimal metabolic function within an individual's body. What that means is you have a state of optimal energy production from your mitochondria. These are the powerhouses in your cells. These are healthy. Your nutrient utilization from your cells and your gut microbes is optimized, plus hormone regulation is well balanced, your blood sugar control is normal, and you're essentially in a state of balance. That's really what we mean by metabolic health. Practically, and in investigation terms, what do we mean? So when I'm looking at a metabolically healthy adult as a doctor, and they come to me as a patient, I know that they are metabolically healthy because they have good insulin sensitivity. They have normal blood lipids on a blood lipid panel. They are of normal weight. And we do weight, like I said in the previous podcast, the rough way is BMI, although I think there are a lot of reservations around that. The best way is going to be using investigations like DEXA scanning or waist hip ratio as a quick sort of rule of thumb. Normal glucose responses to food that we can either measure using a formal oral glucose tolerance test or a continuous glucose monitor, for example. These measures are all suggestive of good metabolic health. Not a clean bill of health, but suggestive of good metabolic health that coalesce to reduce your overall risk of disease. But let's say, for example, you don't have access to all these tests and stuff. You just want an intuitive measure of whether you are metabolic healthy. A metabolically healthy person intuitively knows that they are so because they are of lean weight, they feel energetic, they sleep well, they don't have crashes after eating, they have clear skin, they have less cravings, they feel clear-minded. These are all sort of vague suggestions of metabolic health as well. Obviously, there are lots of confounding. I mean, these are things that are influenced by more than just one's diet or metabolic health status. It can be influenced by physical activity, your stress state, your sleep schedule, emotional health. All these play a part. But overall, those are the things that you want to be thinking of when it comes to metabolic health. If you do have cravings, if you do get headaches, if you do have fatigue, they can be as a result of other things that I always recommend you go and get checked out with your doctor. But overall, those are the things that we think of when we think of metabolic health as well, without those investigations. The best way to see whether these strategies that we're going to talk about on today's podcast are useful is to become a lot more intuitive about how you feel after consuming food and using these strategies. If you're into testing, a bit like myself, you could simply get a blood glucose monitor and measure at regular intervals after consuming food what your responses are like, or continuous glucose monitors that are quite easy to access these days, particularly in the UK, and do your own mini experiments. I don't think it's useful to do it every single time after eating for months or years on end. I think a strategy of seeing how you're responding to your normal diet over, let's say, 7 to 10 days, and doing that periodically, maybe once or twice a year, it's probably going to be something that gives you good behavioral nudges in the right direction and gives you insight into how your body is specifically reacting to the different types of nutrients that you ingest. But again, horses for courses. I think it really depends on the individual as to how specific they want to get with their biology. Okay. Let's start off. So we're going to talk about vinegar. It's a really easy one to start off with because I'm asked a lot about whether you should be consuming vinegar before eating a couple of times a day. You know, I think vinegar had a bit of a thing during the sort of early wellness boom in California. You know, everyone's having their apple cider vinegar in the morning. There's surprisingly very little research on this, but some really interesting mechanisms of action that have been proposed, right? So there was a paper in Diabetes Research and Clinical Practice entitled "Vinegar Consumption Can Attenuate Postprandial Glucose." So attenuate, reduce, postprandial, post meaning after prandial, after eating glucose. This is sugar in the blood that they're specifically referring to as measured by capillary blood. In this case, you can take it from a venous draw, but this is capillary. And insulin responses. So that's your response of the hormone insulin that is used to, yes, drive glucose into cells, but it has a whole number of other uses in the body, as we described in the previous podcast, including stimulation of fats in the liver, et cetera, et cetera. This was a systematic review and meta-analysis of clinical trials. So what they did is they, using some search criteria, grouped all the vinegar trials together, and they looked at the overall benefit or lack of benefit or lack of anything after analyzing all these trials. So this is really interesting because this is a good starting point. If you're just getting to studying, or perhaps you're studying at university, looking at a systematic review and meta-analysis is sort of where you want to start to get like an overall grasp of an area. But the quality of the review that you generate by doing one of these is dependent on the quality of the studies that you put into the review. So if the studies are of poor quality, then what you're going to get out has to be taken with a lot of salt. And I know we're talking about vinegar here. I'm not trying to make a food joke. It's a very bad food joke if it is. But you've got to really be careful about the interpretation of these results. And I make this point now because we're going to go into exactly what went into this systematic review and meta-analysis of the clinical study. So they discussed the non-pharmacologic intervention of using vinegar. So it was in a tablet form or anything, or like a acetic acid powder, which is vinegar, to reduce glucose spikes and thus reduce insulin requirements. And they conducted this review using 11 from 744 analyzed studies. So they were the big bulk of them was over 700, and they whittled it down to 11 that they used in the review to give a more precise estimation of the potential benefits of using vinegar. The largest study out of this whole, of all the 700 plus that they reviewed and whittled down to 11, was 12 individuals. So they only had 12 participants in the largest study that they put into this meta-analysis. The smallest had 5. So, and this is going to be a running theme throughout today's podcast, there are really small trials looking at these interventions. So you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. We're not talking about big cohort studies here. We're not talking about, you know, really well-funded trials either, because no one really stands to benefit from having a bit of vinegar in your diet before you have food, which is why there is a real lack here. And I think citizen science is going to be a big thing when it comes to testing these things, because a pharma company who has the capital and the manpower to be able to do, or people power, whatever you want to say, to be able to do these kind of studies, is going to be lacking because there's no financial upside for them. So anyway, the largest study had 12 individuals, smallest had 5. They used different types of vinegar in the studies as well. So there's a lot of variation in the study. Some used apple cider vinegar, some used red wine vinegar, some used grape vinegar. You get the point. And the range of vinegars, and the range of doses of these vinegars in these different studies ranged from 2 to 50 grams. And there were also different disease states as well. Some people were healthy individuals without any metabolic disease. Some had type 1 diabetes, some had type 2 diabetes. So overall, the review, I'm going to get to the punchline, did reveal a benefit, but there was a significant variation in the results. And also the reviews that they put into this meta-analysis were really, really varied as well. So it's very hard to derive whether vinegar is going to be a beneficial thing for you, or whether you're going to derive the same benefits as a result of this particular study. The net effect does appear to be beneficial. So they do something called a forest plot, where they look at the magnitude of effect throughout all the different studies. You can reference to all these studies at the bottom of the podcast, and you'll find it on the doctorskitchen.com, the website. It does find a benefit looking at that forest plot, but I think it would depend on a number of different factors, like the glycemic index of the actual meal that one is consuming, whether it's high or low in sugars or refined carbohydrates of that existing diet, the type of vinegar that you're using. I mean, you know, that is definitely going to have a difference, because there are different concentrations of acetic acid in different vinegars, ranging from 5 to 10%, sometimes more. Just as a side note, if you are using vinegars for pickling, you want to use a high acetic acid one, because the pickling process would require you to have an antimicrobial effect, so you don't want the food to spoil. So if you are going to be pickling, you want to use a high acetic acid, something like white wine vinegar or malt vinegar or something like that. And if you're not having a very high carb diet, and if you are of healthy weight and don't have a metabolic disease, is this going to have much of an effect? I think the honest answer is we don't know. It could do, it could not do, but we don't know. It depends on the health of the user. It depends on the food matrix, so the combination of different foods that we're going to get onto in a second, and the amount of starches and refined carbs in the meal, as to whether vinegar is going to have an effect or not. So I just want to say that from the start. Mechanisms of action. Why might vinegar have a beneficial impact on your ability to mellow the glucose spike after eating? And we'll get into exactly why we'd want to mellow it in a second as well. Well, the potential mechanisms include inhibiting the activities of the sugars in the small intestine as well. So reducing the activity of that sugar. It could also, the acetic acid specifically can stimulate the uptake of glucose into peripheral tissues. Remember, in the previous podcast, we talked about these different savings accounts for your sugar balance, right? So you don't want to keep it in the blood. It's very, very tightly regulated in the blood. Around 4 grams of sugar is in my blood right now at any point in time. And if it goes outside of that for long periods of time, that's not a good thing. That's where you get hyperglycemia. That's where you get the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes and all the downstream complications of that. The other peripheral tissue states that we tend to have, muscles, flexing my muscles right now, for those of you watching on YouTube, liver and fat cells. So it can potentially improve the uptake of glucose into those peripheral cells. It can also suppress digestive amylases. We'll get into that a little bit later when we talk about supplements and why that might be a good thing. So again, further reducing the absorption of those sugars so they pass through the digestive tract without going into your bloodstream, and maybe even improving the sensitivity of insulin receptors on the peripheral tissues as well. Another thing that a lot of people cite is it delays gastric emptying. That when you have delayed gastric emptying, it can lead to early satiety, bloating, nausea, vomiting. This is a very severe condition, a very uncomfortable condition for people who have this delayed gastric emptying to a pathological degree. And we have medications for this as well. The abdominal discomfort that can be caused from that and the poor appetite can be very, very troublesome for a lot of people. It can be caused by things like medications, nerve damage, hormonal disorders, lots of reasons as to why. But just slightly delaying the gastric emptying rate slows the amount of sugar that your intestines are exposed to, which would stand to reason that it would blunt the rise in sugar in your bloodstream. So essentially mitigating those spikes of sugar, which can potentially reduce the postprandial glucose excursions, the PPGE, as we'll talk about a little bit later. Then it stands to reason, like, if you do have a condition called gastroparesis, which is where you have a pathological delay in the absorption of food, could it worsen the issue of gastroparesis? Again, I don't know. I can't really comment on that. It would stand to reason potentially, but you know, I haven't seen any adverse studies or paper reports, but I'm not too sure. It might be something to just be aware of if you are diagnosed with gastroparesis and if you have that condition. Long-term studies looking at vinegar, pretty non-existent. I mean, like, if the short-term studies are that scarce and that small, it's very unlikely that we're going to have any long-term studies. So we don't really know whether having more vinegar in your diet regularly would reduce the impact on, reduce your likelihood of insulin resistance, say, or have a meaningful impact on HbA1c, which is a marker that we test in the blood to see whether you're at risk of type 2 diabetes or how well you are removing glucose from your blood sugar, your bloodstream. So at the moment, I would say it's an unproven option for type 2 diabetes. And the dosing is a bit of a difficult one as well. Because of the variability of the doses used in studies, it's hard to determine what dose would be adequate if it is going to have any effect whatsoever. But around 1 to 2 tablespoons of vinegar before meals is what I would experiment with if you were interested in experimenting with it. One thing I would say is don't just take a tablespoon of vinegar, dilute it in water, because it can be very abrasive, depending on the concentration of the acetic acid as well. It can be very abrasive to your throat. And I think there have been case reports of enamel damage in dental journals from people overusing lemon in water as well as vinegar without properly diluting it as well. I don't think it's going to be an issue if you dilute it, but just something to be aware of. Should you try it? This is where I get asked about it a lot. Look, I don't think it's going to cause any harm. So in my case, it's like, why not? Can I say it's generally safe? Probably, yeah, I would say so. Depending on whether you do have gastroparesis or any other conditions that could be worsened by further delaying the gastric emptying. But I think it's probably going to have a modest effect. And whether if you're a healthy person, is it going to have an impact? Who knows? I would say it's probably one of those worth testing. See how you feel, see how convenient it is. If you're going to have a high carb meal, is it worth taking it? Probably. And actually, this is something I might try do myself and do a little experiment with a continuous glucose monitor, have like a high carb meal, like burger, chips, like, you know, shake. I mean, I barely have this kind of stuff, but you know, if I'm going to carb up, maybe I'm going to have a little bit of vinegar before and just see what happens. I think it could be an interesting preemptive action if you know you're going to have that and you don't want to feel horrible later. And I hate that feeling of like bloating and crashing and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I don't want to give up eating those delicious foods. So maybe this is something I might do to just mitigate some of the potential effects. You know, it's kind of like when I drink alcohol, which I do fairly irregularly, I would say these days, I take we have something in the UK called Darolite, which is basically like a salt and sugar solution. We tend to give it to kids who've got diarrhea and vomiting or adults to replace the salts that you're losing as a result of diarrhea and vomiting. It's hydrating. It's got a real easy sort of mellow taste. And I'll have one of those diluted in 300-400 mils of water before I have drinks later on today. I'm not recommending you drink. I'm not recommending anyone over consume alcohol as a result of, like, you know, mitigating the potential hangover effects with a salt sugar solution. But it is something that I feel for me works to hydrate myself, because I hate getting a headache the next day. And I, you know, I'm such a loser with this. Like I barely drink these days. And if I have more than two drinks, if I have two drinks, two glasses of wine, two whiskeys, whatever it might be, the next day I feel it. And so that for me is, you know, I've just kind of reduced my alcohol to only really drinks that I absolutely love and when I want to. But if I am going to drink one or two drinks, then I'll have a sugar salt solution. So I digress. That's sort of the way I would view having vinegar. It's not something I'm going to do every meal time, but maybe as a preemptive action when I know I'm going to carb up. Some of the authors have suggested that it's a promising functional food to improve glycemic control. It might be useful for type 2 diabetics, but you know, from a cultural point of view, I think, you know, it's commonly consumed in traditional foods, whether you look at Korean kimchi, for example, or Indian achars, pickles, chutneys. It's also used in soups, you know, like a tom yum soup. It's used in salad dressing, sauces, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, maybe there is a cultural element or like an ancestral knowledge that has been passed down somewhat. And, you know, maybe it's just one of those things that would normally be consumed as part of our traditional diets, whether or not that was specifically to prevent things like obesity and the post-glycemic spikes, the post-prandial spikes, who knows? But yeah, interesting to note that vinegar is a very, very common part of our diet, as probably because of the antimicrobial effects as well, and the preservation of food before we had fridges, which is a relatively new invention along our evolutionary journey. Okay, the second strategy, hack, tactic. I'm pretty interested in this one. I think this is a good rule of thumb, and this is the order in which one eats their foods, also known as sequential nutrient ingestion or nutrient sequencing, the order in which you have your different macronutrient components of your food. I think this is a good heuristic, you know, a useful tool that you can use in day-to-day life. Simply switching the order in which you consume foods, I think, is just a good sort of tool to have in your toolbox of like how you might like to consume foods when you're out, for example. There have been studies looking at pre-loading before having foods, and they usually use things like whey proteins prior to meals and other sort of like high protein supplements. But I think those are pretty impractical. I think when you're away from your kitchen, you're not always going to be like having these preload sachets or whatever, which is why I'm bullish on the use of this simple order of foods tactic rather than actually having to have something with you at all times before you eat foods. Again, very limited studies, unfortunately, looking at sequential nutrient ingestion. I just like saying that. This one from Nature, 2016, entitled "Manipulating the Sequence of Food Ingestion Improves glycemic control in type 2 diabetic patients under free living conditions. I just want to segue a little bit here. A lot of the studies look at people who have pre-existing metabolic issues. Probably one of the reasons, like type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes, probably one of the reasons is there would be a lot of negative results from healthy users using these kind of tactics because they don't tend to have many high glucose excursions after eating food that would be significantly different when they do these kind of strategies. So that's just something you have to be aware of. A lot of the studies that I'm talking about today are actually using participants that have metabolic conditions. But as you know, millions of people worldwide have type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes or don't even know that they're metabolically unhealthy and are probably on that very early insulin resistant journey that leads them to have the diagnosis of those conditions and all the other ones that we talked about in the previous podcast. I think it's still relevant for most people listening to this as well. So in this study, again, very small, only looked at 20 individuals between the ages of 50 to 75. So you have to question the generalizability of this particular study to you listening to this at home or wherever you are in the car or in the gym. They were specifically, as I said, type 2 diabetic, some of which who were on metformin, which is an anti-diabetes drug. They were asked to monitor their blood glucose using a glucometer in a single day. So it wasn't a continuous glucose monitor study, which is, in my mind, easier. But this is 2016, so I don't think the routine use of CGMs were commonplace. And they also looked at some other biometric details other than the bloods. But we'll stick with just talking about the bloods. They were randomized to either a controlled diet, which was mildly hypocaloric. So they were mildly underneath their caloric needs, their energy needs. And the experimental diet, which was the same, exactly the same diet, but allowing the consumption of high carbohydrate foods only after the high protein and high fat foods at each main meal, lunch and dinner. So for example, they would have meat as the first course, then the veggies, and then the bread or pasta and fruit. And the results, particularly after lunch and dinner, were pretty impressive at reducing these postprandial, post-eating glucose excursions that were seen just at 4 weeks of the diet. So pretty interesting that they were able to see these significant results. And the authors concluded manipulating the sequence of nutrient ingestion might reveal a rapid, feasible, economic, and safe strategy for optimizing glucose control in type 2 diabetes. So as a GP, as a doctor, if I'm listening to this and I've got a patient that doesn't want to change their diet whatsoever, is not motivated to do all the other things that I would love all my patients to do, is this a viable strategy? Potentially, yeah, absolutely. I would say so. I think any nugget or any tiny habit you can instill in yourself or if you're a practitioner in your patients would be wonderful. So if there is an inkling of this potentially having an impact, then I would most likely suggest this in the first instance and see what their glucose control is like after 4 weeks. Now, you know, this isn't generalizable to everyone. Like I said, it's a very small study, but interesting nonetheless. Another one from the BMJ, another one, DJ Khaled, if you know, you know. Carbohydrate last meal pattern lowers postprandial glucose and insulin excursions in type 2 diabetes. This was in 2019. This was a better and more rigorous study, but shorter in length. Still very, very small, 16 type 2 diabetes patients between 35 and 65 on metformin. They ate exactly the same meal across 3 days. So the previous study was more real world, but this was very, very tightly regulated in terms of the exact amounts of foods that these guys were consuming. They had diet one was carbohydrate first, then 10 minutes later, protein and vegetables. The second diet was protein and vegetables first, and then 10 minutes later, they had their carbohydrate. And the third meal was like all the components together, so like a big sandwich. So it was one, two, and three. And the meal, they've been very specific about exactly what the meal was. It was orange juice, ciabatta bread, butter, tomatoes, cucumber, all the calories and the amounts of all those were detailed in the study notes. And then they had their bloods taken at very regular intervals, 30 minutes up to 3 hours, every 30 minutes up to 3 hours. And they looked specifically at glucose, insulin, glucagon like peptide, and glucagon at baseline, and then all those different intervals. The results, which I know you want to hear about, the peaks of glucose after eating food were 53% and 54% lower when carbohydrate was consumed last compared to when carbohydrates were consumed first. And 44% and 44% to 40% lower respectively when all the components were consumed together than the control meal. So I'll just reiterate that. The first meal was when they had the carbohydrates first and then the protein and the vegetables. When you reverse that order, so you have your carbs last, it was much, much lower in terms of the highest peak of glucose after consuming those foods. So that for me is, it's pretty effective as a behavioral strategy to improve postprandial glucose control in patients specifically with type 2 diabetes. And they've got these wonderful graphs in the paper itself where along the x-axis, so if you imagine an xy-axis, so just a very simple graph, along the x-axis you have minutes at 30, 60, 120, etc. And then on the y-axis you have your glucose measured in millimoles per liter, or if you're listening in the States, it's milligrams per deciliter. And then you can very, very clearly see that the carbohydrate first diet has a peak of a lot higher, 50% higher than the carbohydrate last pattern. So this, again, really, really interesting to see that just this little change can have quite a drastic effect, at least in the short term. The interesting thing about the study is that they crossed over the patients into different eating patterns. So this was seen as an average across the whole study design. And we'll get into a bit about study design a little bit later as well. The mechanism of action. Why on earth might this be happening? Just simply changing the order of food. If you're eating the same food, you're eating the same calories, you're eating the same time period, how on earth can this actually have this much of an impact? Because, you know, this is why I think that the calorie in, calorie out dogma is flawed in a lot of ways, because you've got to think about the downstream effects of having those glucose excursions to high amounts after eating. It's not just going to have an impact on how you feel afterwards and the crashes. It's going to have an impact on your likelihood of putting on weight, on your the production of fats via the liver, on your overall cardiovascular disease risks. These things over time are going to accrue. So, you know, calories in, calories out doesn't capture these kind of nuances. And it might be small, you know, we can't generalize, but I think it's still very interesting to be aware of. So what is the mechanism? So the best article I found on the potential mechanism of why carbohydrate last pattern or nutrient sequencing might have an impact was from a review article in 2019, Frontiers of Endocrinology. Like I said, all the references will be at the bottom of the podcast show notes on thedoctorskitchen.com. If you're not signed up to the newsletter, you should definitely sign up to the newsletter. It was called The Impact of Nutrient Type and Sequence on Glucose Tolerance. Preloading with fats and proteins before carbohydrates, again, delays gastric emptying. So very similar mechanism to potential mechanism of vinegar. That delayed gastric emptying consequently slows the rate of carbohydrate absorption into your bloodstream. Potentially, another mechanism is it enhances insulin secretion from beta cells. So these are the beta cells in your pancreas, which is where insulin, the hormone, is generated. And it also may reduce insulin clearance. So you have more insulin floating around your bloodstream and probably in lower amounts doing its thing of pushing your glucose into peripheral tissues and the other things that serve to lower your blood glucose level. We've talked a lot about postprandial glucose excursions, also known as postprandial hyperglycemia, if it is to a level that is in the pre-diabetic or diabetic type 2 range, which is above 7.8 millimoles per liter if you're thinking about the oral glucose tolerance test, or above that 11.1, looking specifically at the UK guidelines. It's a very important therapeutic target to reduce these excursions and optimizing for glycemic control. Now, there is some controversy around this, which is why you've got one camp, which is kind of anti using continuous glucose monitoring for people who are otherwise healthy. And then you have the other camp, which is more so the camp that I'm in, which is where we should really know what things are spiking our glucose levels, even if it doesn't suggest that we are pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic. And the reason is because, like I said in the previous podcast, insulin resistance can precede the diagnosis of metabolic diseases like type 2 diabetes by 10 to 15 years. So I would want to know as an individual what kind of foods are spiking my glucose and what I can do about it to mitigate that. The other thing is, what happens when you have this big glucose spike? And I've had big glucose spikes after eating upwards of, 11, 12, 13. It doesn't necessarily put me in the diabetic range because it goes back down very, very quickly. But what's happening is you have a pro-atherogenic vascular environment that's characteristic of type 2 diabetes if it's persistent. But what happens when you have this excess glucose floating around the blood, like we described in the previous pod, is you get lots of inflammation, you get oxidation that damages your cells, you have this pro-thrombotic environment, so pro-thrombotic, so these proteins that can cause clotting, and it stimulates the production of fats from your liver that ends up in the blood and overall increases your risk of cardiovascular disease over time as well. So if you're consistently throwing yourself into this pathogenic microenvironment, even if it is for short periods of time, you can imagine that these periods of time accrue, right? So you're constantly putting yourself in this state of stress. And your body is really resilient, one off to completely fine. Doesn't matter if you're going to have you're going to have a blowout, you're going to have some cake, you're going to have a burger, absolutely fine. But if it's continual and it's daily, which I believe a lot of people put themselves into this environment, if you think about a typical meal deal, you've got white bread, you've got fried chips and a bag of crisps, or I don't know what you call it in the States, probably chips. Chips is something very different in the UK. You have a fizzy drink. This is a normal deal. This is a very normal lunch for, I would say, the vast majority of the population as it's so cheap as well. And I would bet that this is causing a lot of glucose excursions for millions of people without even knowing it. And so these little glances toward this pro-thrombotic environment, this pro-inflammatory environment, over time will have an impact on your body's resilience against impact. So I think it's very important to just realize that it is beneficial to A, be aware of postprandial glucose spikes, but also be mindful of what we can do to reduce those as well. So that's just sort of one segue is to, because you're going to hear me say postprandial glucose excursions or postprandial glucose or hypoglycemia a lot in today's podcast. And an excursion sounds quite fanciful, doesn't it? Like going on a holiday. It's where your excursion is above what is normal in your bloodstream. We discussed what was normal in the previous podcast as well. The other thing it can do, which I think is probably more from a real world perspective, is these glucose dips and crashes that occur as a result of high glucose in the blood for a short period of time is statistically significant in changing your hunger signaling, as suggested by a number of different papers, including one in Nature 2021, where they looked at 1,000 participants using a CGM in an at-home setting. So they recorded over 8,000 controlled meals, and they found that if you have a postprandial glucose excursion, you're more likely to be hungry. And if you think you're more likely to be hungry, you're probably going to be reaching for those savory snacks or the sweet snacks that are probably going to be unhealthy. And again, the sort of cycle continues. And I think everyone's had that experience, including myself, particularly when I was working as a general practitioner, and, you know, I mean, probably 5-6 years ago now, when I was working as a GP in London, and you have those biscuits that patients bring in for you, and you have this, you know, this dopamine rush, and you have that, and then you have a corresponding crash, and you get hungry again. That's most likely what is happening at a macro scale, and what has been demonstrated to increase hunger levels and potentially all those downstream effects of overeating as well. So my opinion is that even people who are otherwise quote unquote healthy should understand postprandial glucose excursions and why we want to reduce them as well. Okay, third thing. So we've already talked about vinegar. We talked about nutrient sequencing. Let's talk about another thing that I'm really bullish on as well. I'm really excited about this one because I have learned some things that I'm probably going to put into practice myself. This is all about extra fiber, veggie starters, and whole food fiber supplements. Not only does this impact the postprandial glucose excursions, but it can also have an impact on your gut microbiota in general as well, because you're upping your fiber content. You heard me talk about it on the podcast many, many times again, that more fiber in the diet is associated, a more variety of different fibers in the diet is associated with drastic reductions in all-cause mortality, and specifically the types of diseases that impact us mostly in the Western world, in the UK and US healthcare systems. A lot of the studies that I'm going to mention are supplemental in nature, but the best evidence we have at reducing the risk of disease is from whole foods and getting more fiber from whole foods in your diet as well. So I want to make that caveat at the start. I am going to be talking about supplements, but in my head, in the back of your head as well, you should always understand more fiber from whole foods is the key. Okay, two further distinctions I want to make from the start. You've got lots of different types of fiber subtypes. Broadly, you can categorize them in soluble and insoluble fibers. There is controversy about, you know, actually categorizing them into, can you really, that in reality, you know, when you eat a nut or you have a whole grain, it's going to have all these different types of fibers in it. But broadly, for the purpose of the of these studies and just getting it clear in your head as to why, as the difference of mechanism of action, we're going to categorize them as soluble and insoluble. Soluble fibers like psyllium and methyl cellulose, pectin that you get from fruit, beta-glucans, you get them from like vegetables, oats, barley. These are the types of fibers that create a gel, and they improve a hyperglycemia after eating by slowing the absorption of glucose in the bloodstream. I'll talk a lot more about the mechanism in a second. Insoluble fibers that you tend to get from things like nuts and seeds and pulses and certain whole grains, they don't appear to have that gelling effect, but they are associated in reductions in things like type 2 diabetes in longer term studies, suggesting another mechanism, which is unknown, probably if I'm a betting person, which I'm not really, it's going to reduce insulin resistance by improving your gut microbiota. So giving your gut microbes lots of interesting stuff to eat when they're feeling hungry. Overall, it was a study that was published in the American Diabetes Association journal 2019. It was entitled Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis to Measure the Effect of Viscose Fiber Supplementation on Glycemic Control. Viscose, they're specifically talking about soluble fibers like psyllium. And they looked at 28 randomized controlled trials of type 2 diabetes patients in specifically. So this is just for type 2 diabetes patients. You've got to really think about whether this is generalizable to you if you don't have this diagnosis. But like I've said throughout this, I think it's generally something that could be beneficial for a lot of people. In this meta-analysis, remember, they group all the best studies that they could find on the subject of having fiber supplements in the diet at reducing and improving glycemic control. They mainly were looking at psyllium that you can get in psyllium husk. We'll talk a bit about exactly where psyllium comes from in a second. Beta-glucan, which most people will recognize is from barley and oats. Konjac. I'm actually a big fan of konjac noodles. A lot of people don't like them, but they come sort of pre-cooked in packets, and you just throw them into stir fries and stuff. I believe it's grown in Asia. And guar gum, which is an additive that you tend to find to change the sort of physical properties of food. So it's sort of like gel. And in this meta-analysis, they found that the absolute reduction overall, looking at all these different studies, in HbA1c, which is one of these blood markers that we use to determine your glycemic control over the preceding 120 days, was 0.58%. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot. I'll get into that in a second. In general, they also showed a reduction in fasting blood glucose of 0.82 millimoles per liter. And another marker that we've talked about in the previous podcast, HOMA-IR, which is a measure of insulin resistance, it has its caveats, 1.89. So again, significant reductions. And this is for a dose of around 13 grams per day for around 8 weeks. Something I didn't know before reading this paper is that the FDA, so the Food and Drug Administration, have a threshold effect on glycemic markers like HbA1c for new drugs that are targeted at type 2 diabetics. And it's got to be an impact of over 0.3%. So for me to have a drug that goes through further development, I've got to demonstrate that my drug can drop your HbA1c by at least 0.3%. In this meta-analysis, they found that on average, using one of those different types of fiber supplements, so psyllium, beta-glucan, konjac, and guar gum, reduced HbA1c by 0.58%. So almost double the amount that the FDA recommend will have as a threshold before you can even start drug development. So I'm not trying to suggest that this is better than drugs, you know, we should stop all the anti-glycemic agents. Not at all. I'm just saying it's a pretty powerful effect. Now, again, like I said in the previous one, meta-analyses are, the quality of your meta-analysis is dependent on the quality of the studies that you put into them. And as we know, these kind of supplement studies or fiber studies, because no one has a patent on psyllium and beta-glucan, they're going to be pretty poor studies. But I really think that the food as medicine concept is an important one that we should all appreciate. And it's not a quirky, cute thing. It's actually something that stands to reason we should be investigating more of. Because if I have patients that don't do well on drugs for whatever reason, or have an aversion to them, or have side effects, which many people do, then I'd want to have a more natural, well-tolerated, different approach that I could either use synergistically or I can use instead of and monitor the effects of. So I think it's just something that, you know, the more studies I've read over the last 14, 15 years looking at food as medicine just sort of heightens my bullishness and my positivity around this subject. And I think it's going to become more and more commonplace as well. Let's look at specific supplements. So that was the overall sort of meta-analysis that I found in the latest one, because that was 2021. Let's look at specifically psyllium husk. And I'm particularly excited about psyllium husk because I have mildly elevated cholesterol. It's likely going to be a genetic thing as a result of my heritage. I don't do well with statins. I was really impressed by the impact of psyllium husk on lipid markers. There are lots of trials on looking at psyllium husk on cholesterol. I'm not going to go into that today. I'm going to try and keep it to glycemic control. But a lot of the studies were looking at both together. So in a small trial of 20 people, again, very small trial, Nature 2002, they looked at type 2 diabetics treated with glibenclamide, which is a sulfonylurea. Sulfonylurea is a type of medication that directly stimulates the production of insulin from your pancreas beta cells. So they were already on medication before this. They were given 3.5 grams of psyllium 4 times a day before breakfast and mealtime. And they took their bloods at regular intervals as well. There was 1 week, which is phase one, where all the subjects followed a diet for diabetes. It was the same standardized diet for diabetes. And they received the same medication as well. Phase two, over 6 weeks, which is where the patients had, again, the same diet, but they also received the psyllium as a supplement. And phase three, which is for another 4 weeks, where and they had very importantly they had what's called a washout, which is where you don't take anything, you don't take any recordings, and then you do the diet for a time afterwards, and it's called a washout. So you remove the impact from psyllium if there is any impact at all, and then you measure. This is really, really important trial design, because what you're trying to determine here is when you introduce psyllium as the agent, or let's say this is a medication, you introduce that agent and you take it away, if psyllium is having an effect, it should diminish when you take it away. And if it doesn't, then you know that there's something else that's potentially having an impact, not just the psyllium itself. So really, really important trial design. And that's exactly what happened. So at phase one, which is where they had just a regular diet, if you imagine an x-axis and a y-axis, again, you have time and you have glucose on the y-axis. They found that you have a typical glucose excursion or high glycemic level after eating, peaking around 60 minutes. And the average for this 20-person cohort was around 14 millimoles per liter, which is fairly high. When they had the psyllium, on average, it was around 2 to 3 millimoles less. And then when they went to phase three, which is where they took away the psyllium, it went back to the level that they had in phase one. So further giving some evidence that psyllium was definitely having an effect in this small trial of 20 people. So what they record in these kind of studies where they look at these insulin curves and postprandial glycemias is something called area under the curve. So the amount of area under the curve that you've diminished as a result of your agent. So you're essentially exposing yourself to less glucose, less sugar in the blood over that same time period. And it was around 12.2% lower in the presence of the psyllium. But there was variability between the participants. Other trials have showed similar effects. So psyllium, for me, we'll go into why that might happen with the gelling impact in a second. But psyllium, for me, is a really interesting agent. It also tends to have a lipid-lowering effect as well, which is quite interesting for me. And also patients that I see who don't want to take a statin for whatever reason, they don't do well with it, and they've tried all the other ones, and there are significant side effects with statins. So this could again be something that we think of when we treat patients who are motivated. Okay, other ones, beta glucan. So beta glucan, like I said, comes from oats and barley, lots of other veggie plant based ingredients as well. This trial called the BELT study that was published in 2020 in Nutrients. Aim to look at the effect of lipid profile as well as glycemia and intestinal health as well. A big caveat for this one, part industry sponsored. So you always could look at in the acknowledgement section when you read a study, whether this was funded by someone who has a vested interest, whether it's a drug company, whether it's a particular brand of supplement, whether it's the sugar industry, although previously they haven't really declared that. Harvard, I'm looking at you. In this particular study, they looked at Italians, 83 Italians on a Mediterranean diet with moderate hypercholesterolemia and low cardiovascular risk profile. So fairly healthy, but they do have a little bit high numbers in their LDL-C and ApoB and all the rest of it. Probably someone similar to me, although I think this in this group, they're a bit older. They gave them 3 grams of oat beta glucans per day. So it was a proprietary formula, and that's what I mean. It was industry funded, and they specifically looked at their fasting glucose and lipids. It was an 8-week trial, double blind, placebo controlled, and crossover. So they gave the interventions to both groups, so 40 in each. They have a washout period where they don't give them anything, and then they swap the groups. So you're literally looking to see if there is an impact, and it's not because of giving it to a particular cohort or giving it to a particular participant. You're monitoring to see whether it has the same effect in the people across the entire trial. And what they found was that there wasn't a significant effect on fasting plasma glucose, potentially because these aren't type 2 diabetics. These people didn't have any obvious issues with glucose after eating. They didn't have these big spikes after that you would expect from a pre-diabetic or a type 2 diabetic, but they did reduce LDL-C cholesterol. It reduced it by 12.2% from baseline after just 4 weeks, and then 15% after 8 weeks. So pretty big effect. And again, something that I'm looking at myself. The equivalent of 3 grams of beta-glucan, most people are going to ask me about, is around 150 grams of cooked oats per day. Or pearl barley as well. Again, similar amount for 150, 160 grams of pearl barley cooked. Should you try it as in beta-glucan? Potentially for cholesterol. Doesn't appear to be beneficial for glucose in normal healthy individuals. But as far as fasting glucose measurement goes, probably not. But maybe for lipids, yes, absolutely. Same thing with psyllium husk. Yeah, potentially. If you're type 2 diabetic, there does appear to be some evidence for that. Whether or not it would have an impact on you as a healthy individual and preventing crashes and stuff like that, not too sure. But, you know, something that I think would potentially be a healthy addition to a diet. And I'm certainly going to be looking at it as well. Another review looking at a higher dose of beta-glucan, so 6 grams per day for at least 4 weeks, they did show that it improved blood sugar for individuals with type 2 diabetes. So, you know, maybe it has an impact in people who are already at that stage of poor insulin sensitivity, but, you know, it's hard to tell whether it's going to have an impact if you're a healthy individual. Does it have to be supplements? No. In fact, my wife, she hates psyllium husk. And she's tried it before for digestive reasons. Sorry for revealing her digestive habits on the podcast. Sorry, she doesn't listen to the podcast anyway. She hates it. She's like, it's jelly. It's disgusting. I wouldn't have it. So are there things that we can do with whole food to prevent glucose spikes after eating? And it turns out there is. And it was a very recent paper in the European Clinical Journal of Nutrition 2023. They showed, it was titled Beneficial Effects of Pre-Meal Almond Load. I love this term. Pre-Meal Almond Load on Glucose Profile on Oral Glucose Tolerance Tests and Continuous Glucose Monitoring. It was a randomized control trial in Asians with pre-diabetes. I think this is a very, very important thing that I probably haven't made clear enough in this whole series. We did talk about genetics and the impact of genetics on one's likelihood of insulin resistance. Looking at South Asians is very important. There's a podcast I did with Professor Kuna, who's a cardiologist, who runs the lead researchers in the UK South Asian Biobank study, aiming to get over 100,000 South Asians, people of South Asian origin, to get their results and figure out where the issues are with why we are at more risk of things like type 2 diabetes and poor metabolic health and all the downstream consequences of that. The pattern of high blood glucose in Asians with type 2 diabetes is characterized by this big predominance of postprandial hyperglycemia, these big glucose spikes afterwards. So figuring out if there is something that we can do specifically for this population is of utmost importance. It has a big impact, a big expense, a big morbidity on this. And I'm always told, like, from people from my community, oh, I should have been more in for the Asians and all this kind of stuff. Well, I am. If you're listening, I am. So also another side note, even in lean, healthy South Asians like myself, we are shown to have higher postprandial glycemic excursions and lower insulin sensitivity for the same carbohydrate load as people from other backgrounds, European Caucasians, Chinese, Arabic Caucasians. We will have a higher excursion and higher likelihood of insulin resistance than our counterparts. So this is just something we have to be aware of. And that's why I think this study was really interesting. So in this study, they plan to research the effect of ingestion of almonds before major meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and on hyperglycemia after eating with pre-diabetes. So these 60 people, again, small study for obvious reasons now, 60 people were preloaded with almonds I'll tell you exactly how much in a second. They all had pre-diabetes. They weren't type 2 diabetic yet, but they were pre-diabetes. So on their way to type 2 diabetes. The amount of almonds they gave, 20 grams, handful, 30 minutes before having an oral glucose tolerance test. And then before meals, 6 grams per day. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So there were two phases of this particular study. Phase one, which is where they're looking at the oral glucose tolerance test. So that's a test that I referenced in the previous podcast, where you're given a 75 grams of glucose load, and then you take blood measurements at regular intervals afterwards to see what your response is to that high sugar load. And the second part of this test, in the second phase of this study, they stuck a continuous glucose monitor on them, and they looked at their responses to food in the real world over a period of 3 to 7 days, I think it was. So really, really interesting study design, one in a more sort of controlled setting and another in a more sort of real world setting. The important thing, again, with this, there was a washout period in the middle, but you know exactly what that means now. And they also crossed over the participants as well. So when they gave them the almonds, they also had another group that was the control, and then there was a gap in the middle, and then they crossed over those participants. So again, you're seeing, you're ensuring that there is an effect, if there is an effect, that's present in both populations rather than for some other explained reason as to why, you know, almonds might be beneficial for certain cohorts and not for the others. And the results is that this pre-meal almond load treatment of 20 grams handful before breakfast, lunch, dinner reduced postprandial blood glucose by 18% on the oral glucose tolerance test. So that's the more formal measurement, and 10% on the more real world part of the study using the continuous glucose monitor. That's pretty impressive. Just having a handful of nuts before is something very, very simple to do. Can always keep nuts on you and stuff, have your nuts before, and then have the same meal. It can have that beneficial impact on your blood glucose. The other benefits of having nuts in your diet, we've explained that before. It's got magnesium, vitamin E, zinc. The PREDIMED study showed that having some nuts in your diet may reduce cardiovascular risk profile. So net benefit here, and no pharmaceutical side effects, complications of that. Obviously, if you're nut allergy, probably not useful. But if you don't, might be something to investigate. There was a significant reductions in serum insulin and plasma glucagon as well. So lots of other potential benefits in this. And there's a lovely sort of blood glucose graph in this study. Again, the reference is in the show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com, where you see the test and the control, and then the average. You can really see a big, big difference in that 10% reduction. And 10% doesn't sound like a lot, but over time, that is really impressive. So, you know, I think this, again, as just another little thing to nudge your patients toward better habits is something that I think is a good strategy. If you can't get someone to, you know, exercise every day or completely overhaul their diet, these little nudges in that direction can potentially have remarkable effects on reducing morbidity and ultimately mortality. So, and the authors actually state in this, adopting such strategies to manage hyperglycemia, especially in a pre-diabetes state, can be helpful in delaying or controlling conversion to diabetes, or even help reversal to normal glucose regulation. One of the really interesting thing about this particular study is that on the oral glucose tolerance test, some of their participants actually reverted after having the almond meal, actually reverted to normal levels, i.e. they weren't diagnosed with pre-diabetes anymore. They actually managed to reduce their glucose spike to the normal level, which meant that, you know, they weren't pre-diabetic. So what the long-term ramifications would be of having almond meal every single day, it's impossible to tell using this study alone, but it is interesting nonetheless. Let's talk a bit about the mechanism of action of all these different supplements. So we've mentioned psyllium, beta-glucan, and almonds. Psyllium, what happens, I've alluded to it, it has this gel-forming property. It's a soluble dietary fiber. So what happens is it turns into like a jelly, and it basically inhibits the absorption of the sugars into the bloodstream, which would stand to reason why it blunts that postprandial glucose response. It can also potentially benefit certain blood lipids as well. So these fibers, they go into your stomach, they create this gel, and it slows the digestion of food. It helps lower that blood sugar by delaying and reducing the glucose absorption into blood. And fiber also speeds up the rate at which food moves through your intestinal tract. So it has less chance of being absorbed and spiking your blood levels in your bloodstream, your sugar levels in your bloodstream as well. We've talked a lot about soluble fibers, but the insoluble fibers in multiple long cohort studies, those are associated with better insulin sensitivity. So it isn't like the soluble fiber show here. It's got to be about having both insoluble and soluble fibers. So ultimately, you really just want to think about getting more fiber into your diet as well. Specifically, looking at the almond study, what are the potential mechanisms of action? Well, when you preload yourself with almonds, you have a handful of almonds, and it wasn't funded by the almond board of growers or whatever it might be. It could have a very similar effect with walnuts. It could have a similar effect with pistachios or pine nuts or whatever nut of your choice. Mine's walnuts, actually. But the potential mechanism of action is that it stimulates the release of insulin sooner than being stimulated by the food itself. So when you start eating your meal, you're prepared. You're ready to go. And that way, you're more likely to have less of a glucose spike because your body is already in a state where it's ready to absorb food. It probably speaks to why eating slower tends to have a better impact on your feeling of satiety, your feeling of fullness, and the improving the likelihood that you're not going to overeat as well. So always trying to eat slow, put your fork down in between bites, all that kind of stuff is really important. And I would say it's in line with why this strategy might work as well. The fiber content of almonds is going to obviously increase the viscosity of your intestinal contents, which again hinders the glucose diffusion across the into the intestine. And then the other element is that almonds have high zinc and magnesium content that could also stimulate a certain receptor in your fat cells to improve insulin sensitivity. So there are some other sort of more nuanced mechanisms as to why almonds or nuts in particular might have a beneficial impact on postprandial glucose excursions. But those are kind of like not really well tested at the moment. Most of those potential mechanisms come from my studies, and there are a lot of issues with those as well. I wouldn't get too caught up in the whole insoluble, soluble timing, all that kind of stuff. Go for whole foods, try supplementing if you like. I'm going to be using psyllium husk for reasons other than just postprandial glucose excursions. Should you try it? Yeah, I would say so. I would say a minimum of 30 grams, 50 grams a day. The benefits of those kind of accrue. Sorry, not psyllium, for nuts. For psyllium husk, it's 3.5 grams. Very simple, very easy to get. And gradually increasing your fiber intake if you're not used to having fiber in your diet. I think those are relevant things to do for sure. If you're looking for psyllium husk in the health food store or supermarkets, it's also called Isbergula husk. It's obtained from the seed of the husk of the plant Plantago ovate. And it's native to herb regions from Asia, Europe, and North Africa. And it's got this sort of, it's a really odd name, mucilage. It's an adhesive gelatinous substance, almost similar to natural gums. It doesn't sound very appetizing. It's not really meant to be something you add to food, but you know, hey ho, it's got a functional property that I think is very interesting. Fourth thing, let's go. So we've talked about whole fiber supplements, nuts before eating. We talked about vinegar, order of foods, moving after eating. This is a really interesting practice. And I think it dates back to Ayurvedic teachings, actually. There is a saying, I think it's either 100 steps or 1,000 steps after eating. These are things that you should do. And it makes sense. You know, we talked a lot about exercise in the insulin resistance podcast, you know, the mechanism of action as to why exercise over time improves one's insulin sensitivity is because it improves the uptake of glucose into your peripheral cells. It reduces inflammation, increases muscle mass. It has improvements in ectopic fat distribution. GLUT4, the receptor induction induces that, improves mitochondrial size, number, loads and loads of reasons as to what exercise over the long term has this impact. But what about straight after eating? Okay, so there was a study in 2022 published in a public health journal. And again, very small study, 23 healthy, active young individuals, and they were randomized to one of three different exercises, 30 minutes of walking after eating, 30 minutes of stepping, and 30 minutes of squatting against the control, which is just simply sitting at a desk. And I think this is really interesting because what they're trying to do is mimic what potential things you can do without having to leave your work environment. So the worst case scenario is you have your meal at your desk, al desco as it's colloquially known. I call it al desco. I don't know if that's a thing. If you can't leave your work environment, can you do squats? Even though I think your coworkers will probably have a few words to say about that. Squatting against a wall, stepping, again, I don't think that would be very advisable, or just going for a walk for half an hour. They were really rigorous in determining the speed of walking. They use a pedometer, a metronome, I believe, to count the exact number of steps per minute in a indoor 50 meter track. And then for the stepping and the squatting exercises, again, they counted the cycles, the number of seconds as well per minute of the exercise as well. And they standardized the meal. It was cornflakes, milk, sugar. Really interestingly, I would have thought squats would have had a bigger impact than walking, because squats, you're really engaging the large muscles of your body. Maybe that would have had a bigger effect. Actually, walking was the most effective strategy in this very small trial of 23 healthy adults at improving postprandial glycemic response. And at the peak of glucose for sitting, so your control was 7.5 millimoles per liter. So that again is under the diagnosis of prediabetes. So if you're just sitting down, that's what you expect your glucose to be if you're a healthy adult after 30 minutes. If you're walking, it was 6. So you've got a massive reduction in that glucose excursion. Like I said, small study, you know, if the exercise is not performed within 30 minutes after the meal, does that diminish the impact? It wasn't determined. There are similar results from different studies. There was a Japanese study from 2021 that used 20 minutes of walking at 6 kilometers per hour, very slow, like me. I ramble when I walk. I don't walk fast. Only 11 people had a very similar result. Specifically in type 2 diabetes, does that have an effect? Well, there was another study published in Diabetologia in 2016, a randomized crossover study, 41 adults, all with type 2 diabetes, 2 weeks intervention. They were walked 30 minutes each day compared to a 10-minute walk after each main meal. So again, the exercise intervention was the same, but this specifically looked at a random walk in the middle of the day for 30 minutes versus specifically a 10-minute walk after eating your main meal. And glycemia was measured using a CGM. And they found that it was significantly lower when participants walked after meals compared with on a single daily occasion, and particularly striking after the main meal. It was around 12% after across all the meals, but specifically looking at the main meal at the end of the day, which is typically when people have more carbohydrates, it was 22% lower. So this is looking at very low numbers in the studies, potentially very, very impactful on hyperglycemia after having a meal. The best way to see whether any of these interventions are relevant for you is to check with the blood glucose monitor. You can get one from most pharmacies wherever you are in the world and do it manually, or you can get a CGM, which is a little bit more costly, but I think they're worth it because you can actually test these out yourself and actually see whether this is useful for you as well. So would I do this? I would do this. I would suggest this as well. And again, if I have someone who is not motivated to change their diet at all, can I say to them, look, go out for a walk 10 minutes after your meal? Most people could probably commit to that. Most people, it's tiny enough to be able to commit to that. And even if it was just that 10 minutes after your main meal, not even breakfast, lunch, don't worry about that. If you can't get out, don't worry about it. Try just your dinner time. Just try after dinner, 10 minutes walking. Can you do that? Most people can commit to that. That's a potentially really, really good outcome. If it's 22%, if it's, you know, even 15%, really, really good outcome. So I'm pretty bullish on that. So those are the four tactics that I want to go through today. Supplements are things that I don't really talk about too much because I think it's not particularly accessible. I think the impact of them can be quite small depending on which supplement we're talking about. But these are ones that I think are potentially useful, and these are more on the sort of spectrum of whole food supplements. So green tea polyphenols. I love my green tea. I'm actually drinking one right now. I love coffee. And green tea is particularly interesting because it has all these wonderful different phytochemicals, including similar ones that you find in coffee as well. So EGCG, also epigallocatechin-gallate. Epicatechin, gallate, and catechins in general, all different types of catechins. These are potentially anti-obesogenic. And also green tea in those larger trials has been shown to reduce the incidence of type 2 diabetes in a similar way to coffee as well. So there was a study in 2015 that specifically looked at the impact of green tea extracts. So these are extracts from green tea, looking at those catechins, the various catechins in there. This study that was published in Nature Reports, it's kind of hard to pit against all the other ones that we've seen because they weren't looking at post-glucose hyperglycemia, looking at bloods. They were actually using a breath test in humans. So kind of hard to put apples to apples, but it was placebo-controlled crossover trial looking at 28 healthy adult volunteers. They gave them a single dose of green tea extract, the dose of which was around 4 grams. They had specific amounts of all these different catechins as a powder, and they were given a cornflake-based test meal. And they collected these breath samples at 30 to 240 minutes afterwards at 30-minute intervals, and then they crossed them over after a week. One arm went into the placebo, the other arm went into the actual green tea extract. And their data suggested that it is, in their words, a viable alternative to pharmaceutical inhibitors of glucoside hydrolyzed enzymes. And it decreased starch digestion and absorption due to the extract. So the reason why this might work is because we have these particular enzymes that break down the starches that leads to the absorption of the sugars into the bloodstream, and green tea extract may reduce the efficacy or inhibit the action of those particular enzymes as well, which stand to reason you're going to absorb less of the sugars, going to spike you less, and you're going to have less postprandial glucose excursions. And another crossover trial, it's a different trial here, 11 healthy men. They were given a beverage containing catechins and chlorogenic acid, which is something specifically you get in coffee. Again, improved insulin sensitivity in those as well, using their particular markers. There was another one that I thought was particularly interesting. It was more of a real world study in that they gave them consumption of green tea extracts, and after 3 weeks, they found that it suppressed hyperglycemia and insulin after having a high-fat test meal containing 75 grams of glucose, and improved healthy insulin sensitivity in healthy males as well. I think the takeaway from these studies, because they are quite hard to interpret, is that the more polyphenols in your diet, the better. The reason why I'm a big fan of green tea, I'm just taking a sip, is because it's a real rich collection of all these different polyphenols that we don't tend to get in other elements of your diet. And I think that the higher density of various polyphenols you can get in your diet, the better. And that's why you see these studies where you get 30 different plants in your diet, you know, including things like herb spices, coffee. They all count because they're giving a rich variety of all these different plant chemicals that have these anti-obesogenic effects, anti-inflammatory effects, antioxidant effects. You know, these are all potentially protective, which is why I'm a big fan of getting more spices and herbs in your diet at every opportunity. So green tea extract, does it work potentially? Is it going to have a massive effect? I think it's very hard to interpret. Is it worth it as part of your supplement stack if you do want to improve glycemic control? Yeah, potentially, if you can afford it. Again, I think these things, probably best to test yourself and maybe even look at the long-term measures like HbA1c that you can get done by your doctor after introducing these interventions as well. On the subject of spices, cinnamon. Cinnamon is something that I'm asked about a lot because there are lots of pretty good studies, actually. It's very, very well studied. Main takeaway, so two main types of cinnamon. There's cassia cinnamon and there's Ceylon cinnamon. Ceylon is also known as true cinnamon. You get it from Sri Lanka. The important caveat, other than like the species, is cassia cinnamon, which is the more common type of cinnamon. Odds are, if you get cinnamon from your supermarket, it's cassia. It's got 200 times more coumarin in it than Ceylon cinnamon. Ceylon cinnamon has very low, almost indetectable levels of coumarin, and coumarin can have an impact on your liver at high doses. So it is like one of those caveats, potential interactions with lots of medications. Some studies have shown that only the coumarin, the high coumarin containing cinnamon, cassia cinnamon, has the anti-glycemic effect. So whether you can state that Ceylon cinnamon that has a lower side effect profile in its interaction with other medications versus cassia, it's quite hard to say whether Ceylon has the same benefits, but it certainly is probably going to be better tolerated. What is the potential mechanism of action? Similar to everything that we've talked about so far, delays gastric emptying, inhibits digestive enzymes, reduces glucose absorption, increases glucose cell uptake by cells, potentially by enhancing insulin signal, receptor signaling. How much per day? Anywhere between 1 and 2 grams. There may be some extra benefits at higher doses, but you have to mitigate that against the potential side effects of having likely what you're going to be getting, which is cassia cinnamon in the diet, and whether it's the coumarin in the cinnamon that's actually having the anti-diabetic effect or not, it's still something I haven't found a definitive answer on that. For certain people, it's definitely going to be toxic at high doses. So you want to be particularly careful if you are on blood thinning medication like warfarin, blood pressure drugs, diabetes drugs, statins. Like, there are lots of potential interactions with cinnamon. Should you take it because of the side effect profile? I'd be pretty cautious. The other obvious question, legitimate question, is should I be having any cinnamon in my diet? Unless you're having cinnamon every single day and it's not in a supplemental form, I personally wouldn't worry about it too much unless I was on those kind of medications. A one-off is probably not going to have a negative impact. If it's going to be a daily thing, i.e. something that you take in a supplement form, or if you're just a really big fan of cinnamon and you're putting loads and loads of cinnamon into your food, it's something that you should discuss with your doctor or your practitioner. I personally think cinnamon in the diet is fine, as long as it's not like a massive amount and daily. Other supplements. So those are the two commonest ones that I'm asked about: green tea extracts and cinnamon. Other supplements to watch: berberine, which you may have heard of. There's not much in the way of studies, and I'm not as attracted to the idea of using berberine as a supplement because it has similar issues to warfarin in that lots of side effects, lots of potential interactions with medications, so probably best avoided. And actually, individuals tend to have different side effects based on it. Some people complain of headaches or low mood. It's and again, not very well studied. One that I think is one to watch, I alluded to this at the start of today's podcast, is a perennial herb that's been used for thousands of years in Ayurvedic medicine, probably something that my parents would know all about, and I haven't asked them about it yet, and is closely associated with prevention and treatment and cure of obesity and diabetes as per Ayurvedic texts. It's called Salicia oblonga. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Salicia oblonga, super interesting, definitely one to watch. Over the last 10 years, I was looking at PubMed. There's only been 200 studies on this. And I think it's going to be one of those that kind of explodes. Kind of like how curcumin and turmeric kind of went up. If you look at the number of studies on curcumin, it's in the thousands. Salicia oblonga, really, really interesting. From the very few studies that I've seen, there was one in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition 2007. It significantly lowered the postprandial glucose response by 14% for a small dose of 240 milligrams extract and 22% for 480 milligrams of the extract. And 1,000 milligrams has been shown to reduce postprandial glucose in non-diabetics by 25%. That's pretty big. That's up there with the exercise after eating. And again, like very small studies. Whether or not these are definitely not funded, because no one's got like there are very, very few manufacturers of this particular product, but really, really interesting. And I think it's going to have that magnitude of effect. It needs to be studied in a more rigorous way, in a larger amount of cohorts as well. The potential mechanism of action is that it's an alpha glucosidase inhibitor. So similar to medications like Acarbose that we use in diabetics, and Miglitol, it's also called Glycet, it's a trade name. Really, really interesting. I think that's probably one to watch. No affiliation with any of the brands, no affiliation with any of these supplements that I've recommended today. I don't do supplement advertising, as you guys probably know, but really interesting nonetheless. So, you know, I think overall, anything that serves people to reduce those high glucose spikes, improve insulin sensitivity, improves people's behaviors around how they approach meals, I think is really interesting. Everything has to be taken with a dose of guidance, a dose of like a reality, pragmatism. Am I going to have vinegar before every single meal? Probably not. Am I going to have it after before a high carbohydrate meal? I might try that. Order of food. Am I going to, if I'm planning on having a burger, take the burger bun out, eat the burger bun, the veggies, and then the bun? No, I'm going to just eat my burger. But with a dose of pragmatism, if I'm having a meal that has all the different elements separated, am I going to have the beans first and the veggies and then maybe the carbohydrate stuff a little bit later on? Maybe I'll try that. So everything that I've talked about today, when it comes to the order of foods, the fiber supplements, these are things that you need to make a decision for yourself. There are other things that we could also go into. I've decided to stop the podcast now because we could literally go on for hours and hours. Fermented foods, really interesting topic. Should we be having fermented foods at the start of our meal, like a veggie antipasti? And if you look again at very traditional diets, whether it be Japanese diets and washoku, Ayurvedic traditional diets, you know, we always have pickles and vinegars at the start of the meal, and then you consume all the other elements of your meal later on. Is there some sort of pattern? Is there a code in the way our ancestors have always eaten that are suggestive of the medicinal qualities of eating in that sequence? It's hard to tell. Emotional health, massive impact on glucose. Massive impact on adrenaline and cortisol. We know these have an impact on glucose responses, sleep, stress. All these elements, I think, would be features that we have to take into account. Introducing these habits that we talked about in a tiny way so you can stack your habits onto each other. So it's not just you're taking a supplement or a medication, you're actually adding a whole suite of tools that could serve your glucose stability. And there are loads of other supplements that we could have gone into, inositol, probiotics, functional drinks. I think this is also particularly interesting for sufferers of PCOS, whether all the things that I've talked about today and also all the other things that I talked about that are the mainstay of treatment. So the dietary changes, the exercise, the sleep and stress things. I think those could be potentially be really, really impactful for anyone who is suffering with PCOS as well, better managing that as well. So today's been a long podcast. It's been a deep dive into all those different glucose hacks. I really, really hope you found this useful. Please tweet at me any suggestions for supplements that you think I've missed out on that, you know, you'd like me to talk about. Do sign up for the Eat, Listen, Read newsletter, and also check out the Dr. Kitchen app. All of our app recipes are fiber rich, colorful. You know, I'm not going to tell you how to eat the sequence of your those recipes, but you can make that decision yourself. But they are packed with all those different phytochemicals that we've talked about today that are going to be serving not just insulin sensitivity and reducing insulin resistance, but improving your overall metabolic health, cardiovascular health, mental well-being. And we do a massive amount of research before we define which health goals are served to you as well. So definitely check that out. And if you're not subscribed to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, make sure you click follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And I will see you here next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.